93.2 FM.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling. My guest this week to review the news in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Labour Councillor for Eastern, Farouk Chowdhury. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. Following up a story from last week, we have a shocking report which links the mysterious death of government scientist David Kelly just before the Iraq War to a book he was about to publish about the modern world's most dangerous biological weapon, anthrax. Plus, a criminal investigation into alleged misuse of anthrax at the UK's Biological Weapons Research Centre, Porton Down in Wiltshire. That's just before the 6 o'clock news. After the 6 o'clock news, Bristol City Council's parks sell-off bombshell. Back in June, it was announced that the Bristol Evening Post, by the Bristol Evening Post, that the council's planning to sell off 62 parks, bits of parks and other green spaces around the city for housing. I went along to council consultation at Arnos Vale Hotel yesterday to find out what you think of the plan, and I'm joined in the studio by some of the campaigners. That's in the second hour. On to our review of the week's news in a minute, but first, here's our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. This weekend, highs of 20 degrees Celsius, fairly cloudy with some sunny spells on Saturday and some rain on Sunday. Highs of 21 degrees Celsius next week, getting cooler as the week progresses. A fairly dry week, but with the sunniest days midweek. So next weekend, that's the 11th and 12th of September, highs again around 20 degrees Celsius. Good weekend though, dry and sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the Weather Outlook. Well, time to introduce this week's guests now, and with me is Farouk Chowdhury, who's the Labour Councillor for Eastern. Hi Farouk, and welcome to Drive Time.
Oh, hi, welcome.
Now, can you tell us first of all a little bit about your background, Farouk? What were you doing before you became a councillor?
I came into this country in 1998, since then I always was involved with politics, to be honest, when I was in back home Bangladesh, since I'm here, I joined with Labour Party because of the policies of Labour parties, and I actively involved in my communities, and that led me to stand for election in Eastern, and you know, that's how I won.
Can you just tell me what you were doing in Bangladesh? You know, what kind of politics were you involved in, and maybe some of the activities you were up to in politics over there?
I was a student till the day I flew to this country, actually, and I was involved with student politics and involved with my area politics or village politics in my area, which is Roonkeli, Gulafganj and Sylhet, Bangladesh, and involving with lots of activities like youth activities, green activities. For example, we planted lots of trees, roads improvement. As you know, this is a deprived country and there is lots of communication gaps, roads and everything. So I was involved with those, and especially helping with my parent and my dad. He was actively involved, and my uncle was actively involved, and he was an ex-chairman of my area. So I saw politics since my childhood, basically, and since then I'm involved.
So come on, what's the difference then? What's the big difference between Bangladesh and Britain? It must have been quite a shock to see. There must be some differences between the two countries.
It is a huge difference. I mean, I can see here, since I'm involved and since I'm a councillor, I can see the fair politics and the fair democracy. That's the main thing. Through the, you know, the nationally or party-wise, is a very fair way selection and procedure. And justice is here. So I can see the difference. It's a huge gap and huge difference between this country and Bangladesh.
Tell me about some of the issues in Eastern. And just before you came on the air, we were talking about some parks. What are the things that people are coming along to you in your surgeries and telling you about Eastern?
In Eastern recently, although I have to say there is not much parks in Eastern, very few, because it is a inner city area, and there are not many green spaces. Very few.
That means it's more important, the ones that there are looked after properly.
Absolutely. But more recently, I have caseworks people raising me. There are a couple of green spaces which used by group gathering, especially a community member, they gather or they hold their meetings maybe, or they spend most of their days on the park, but large scale of people, that's, and which led lots of litters and fly tippings on those green spaces. And what really concerned the local residents who's been living there long time, they don't take their children onto these green spaces, and that's really concerning me now. And I'm taking these issues basically to our next Eastern Neighborhood Forum, because it has to be prioritized, and we need to, as a Bristol City Council or police, we need to work together to resolve this and address this.
Okay, and what about, how do you think that Barbara Jank is doing as leader of the City Council, as someone who's privy to these big council meetings? You go along to a lot of them. How do you think she's getting on? She's a Liberal Democrat leader, we've got a Liberal Democrat cabinet, and you're a Labour opposition councillor.
Although she is not from my party, I represent Labour, but I think that Labour is the best party to run this city. We has done before, and I'm sure on next election people will mandate us to do it again.
Yes, but why do you say that? What's the difference?
Because we were fit for purpose. We did lots of good things. As I speak here, Bacon Centre, that's from our government, and that's, we had a big influence on it. So I think that the Labour is the best to run this country as well as this city.
Well, you seem to be implying that the Liberals are not fit for purpose.
They are not, certainly, because some of the issues they are handling now, I don't agree with them, and it's totally out of touch.
I think many voters are very confused about who to vote for. They think that many of the parties have very similar ideas. So what's different then, particularly with the issues that are going through the city at the moment between Labour and the Liberal leadership?
The Helen Holland, our leader, she is an experienced person. She has run previously the council, and we run in such a way which was improving residents' life, improving the areas, and we were targeted areas where need to be improvements, such as Eastern, Barton Hill, and those sort of deprived area. But this Lib Dem, I would say they are not experienced enough, and they're not fit for purpose.
But you see, ultimately, the voters elected them in there.
Indeed, they did. So, and that's why the Lib Dem running the council now, and I'm sure voters will realise that, and they will change their opinion next election.
Okay, Farouk, thanks very much for that. Labour councillor for Eastern. Martin Summers, Oxford Economist, is with me too. Martin, our first story this week, the taxpayers, apparently, this is according to The Independent, Tuesday this week, are set to pocket £27 billion from bailing out Britain's banks. The taxpayer apparently stands to get this money from the emergency bailout when the government's stakes in Lloyds Banking Group and Royal Bank of Scotland are sold, these estimates suggest. The public purse can expect to benefit from £19 billion of share price gains, another £2 billion in fees for guaranteeing bank bonds, etc. So actually, it looks as if there's going to be quite a little cash dividend from our Gordon Brown's bailout last year, or the year before.
Maybe is my answer to that, because of course this is all very much a bird in the bush rather than a bird in the hand. They haven't attempted to try and sell the banks yet, because if they try to actually try and sell the shares, they might find that they're not going to get as much as they're estimating here. I think one of the major problems with the banking system is that we're not clear about the bad debts that the banks hold. They've basically been allowed to mark their dodgy assets at full price, and that then means that they show a profit on paper. But in actual fact, I think it's widely believed that if these assets were in fact taken to the marketplace and sold, they wouldn't get anything like what it says on the value on the front of the piece of paper says. So in actual fact, a lot of the banks are basically hiding their bad assets. And a lot of the profits that are claimed to be made are basically not taking this into account. Of course, if the banks say they're making profits, that means they can pay bonuses and they can pay their shareholders. And that's why they're quite keen to say that they are making profits. But it's questionable whether there are actually any real profits there.
This was some information that came out in a trade magazine called The Banker, which last time I looked cost about £20 for the monthly edition of the magazine.
Yeah, the banking industry puts an awful lot of effort into public relations, explaining why they are so indispensable. We've obviously but the nationalisation of the banks was an inevitability given the circumstances.
You can't argue against the cast iron fact here, though, that actually these banking stocks that Gordon Brown bought have been going up in value and up in value.
Yes, that's because, don't forget, the banks are borrowing from the Bank of England at zero interest rates and lending it on to everybody else at a cut. And that's pretty easy to make money if you do that, isn't it? And what we're doing is rebuilding the balance sheets of the banks, supposedly. But it's basically the community at large which is paying the price for this.
But we might not like it, but surely it's good if the taxpayer can benefit from it.
In the long run, it might be a good idea. What personally I think we should do is we should nationalise the banks and keep them nationalised. That's not actually what's on offer for anybody at the moment. I think that we're going to have a second leg of the crisis, and then a lot of these profits are just going to melt away like ice cream in sunshine. And at that point, we will really have to start thinking about what we really want to do about our financial system. We've put it off, essentially, by nationalising them and saying we're going to sell them off. Basically, that's a stopgap measure. I think that the crisis is not over, but anything like over. And once we've been in the second stage of the crisis, then we're going to have to take some more radical measures.
Okay, Farouk, what's your thought on the whole bailout thing? And, you know, I think it's also one of the things that's always in people's minds right now is this recession over, or is it going to be continuing? Is it going to be a double dip?
Although I'm not an expert on economics, but from my experience, what I can see is, you know, the other party blame the Labour because of this recession and because of this financial mess. But I would say it's not for Labour, although the way Gordon Brown handled this situation, keeping the interest rate very low, I am one of the witnesses. If the interest rates would have been reduced, I had to lose my house. And lucky till today, I is manageable. I can pay my mortgage and I can support my family. So the steps Gordon Brown or Labour government has taken is really good step. But it was recovering till now. But I don't know about this government. The step they are taking, I think, is a very chance we may would go to double dip recession. And I'm really worried about that.
Well, every week on Russia's English language channel, Russia Today, former stockbroker and economics expert Max Keiser is on. And this week he looks at Goldman Sachs fraud. Let's have a listen to him. And he wonders whether America's days as a world financial power may soon be over.
This is the Keiser Report. You know, we take on the big banks on this show, and we have, in effect, I want to draw your attention to this Financial Times story this morning. Goldman Sachs' largest investor has slashed its stake by more than half in the last quarter as the bank contended with civil fraud charges by U.S. securities regulators, brought to those regulators' attention by us. That's right. AXA, the French insurance company, dumped Goldman Sachs stock. The stock's under severe pressure. Why? Because we're telling it like it is. The thing that we have here is, of course, there's a peg between the Chinese currency and the U.S. dollar. Bernanke, Geithner, Summers, Obama put $800 billion or so into fiscal stimulation. He put another $800 billion, which became $5 trillion in monetary stimulus. And, of course, that didn't happen, the effect of causing any inflation in the U.S., but it simply went over to China. So, actually, China's inherited America's inflation. So, Bernanke would love to see some inflation in the U.S. because that economy is sinking like a stone, but because all the jobs and all the manufacturing and essentially all the capacity of the economy is in China, all that money that Obama released into the economy has now found its way in China.
And of course, it gives more incentive to them to actually unpeg from the dollar. If they could have the yuan rise significantly, all those prices of goods and, well, food and oil that the consumers in China are complaining about, those would just collapse if they could rejig their currency.
Yeah, they have that as a possibility, and this is the so-called decoupling. That China would allow its currency to appreciate, which would give everybody in China increased purchasing power of the yuan. And then you'd have the slack picked up from any loss of exports to the U.S. You'd create a domestic consumer culture, And they have that option, and I believe that they're just waiting for the right moment to do so. As soon as they get that last American to buy that last Chinese-made good at Walmart, that they can't borrow any more money to buy it, they're going to hit the ripcord and let that yuan appreciate and sayonara America as first world country.
That's Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert there from the Kaiser Report on Russia Today. Martin, when he's talking about sayonara, America as a world economic power, is he exaggerating?
I don't think so. I mean, this has been coming for a generation. When the US government took the dollar off gold in 1971, they basically unwound the existing financial structure. And we were always going to find ourselves in a situation pretty similar to the one we're in now in the end. I think there is a very real danger that the US is going to go into a very, very serious economic decline.
Now, you've moaned many times here about the lack of action by the police on some of the frauds that have been discovered. But it does seem that the market, once it learns of the frauds, also is a sort of counterbalance against some of these crooked banks.
Well, I mean, it's obviously people don't want to buy fraudulent stocks, do they, which are not worth what they claim to be worth. And therefore they'll dump them if they find that they are fraudulent. But an awful lot of what has gone on has been fraudulent. I mean, during the savings and loan scandal in the 1980s in the US, thousands of people were sent to prison for fraud. What's happened this time, which is a much bigger bubble, much more underhand dealing has gone on, but hardly anybody has been punished. And Goldman Sachs, for example, have got a computer program that allows them to front run the market by milliseconds, which basically is a license to print money by them, but it ought to be illegal, but it's they've been allowed to get away with it. All of these bad practices have basically built themselves into the system. It's like what Enron did. The people that cheat and lie actually outcompete the people who play fair, and of course that means that the whole system eventually becomes rotten from the top to the bottom.
Farouk, do you think that's Mark Martin's exaggerating a bit there? He's rotten from the top to the bottom, the financial system?
I quite agree with Martin. I think those people who are responsible for this crisis, they should be bring to justice. Because it's not they are affecting a group of people, they are affecting the whole world, basically, economically. So, Martin, in certain instance, he's right.
So, if there is this opinion out there, that why aren't they?
Well, I mean, the reason, they're very powerful. Don't forget that politics is partly about votes, but it's also about money. If you want to run for election in the US, you need a lot of money. And who's got the money? Oh, it's the bankers. So the bankers then, I mean, Goldman Sachs were the single biggest contributor to Obama's election campaign. Now, it's very difficult for Obama to turn around, having taken millions of dollars worth of donations from these banks, to turn around and discipline them. And this is a fundamental problem. I mean, the Supreme Court in the US has just passed a law that corporations can spend any amount they like on political campaigning with no control whatsoever. And this will make US elections completely dominated by financial muscle. And of course, if you've fraudulently got loads of finance, you can then use your fraudulent finance to finance the politicians and then make them do what you want. And that's the closed circle that runs the show.
Well, I also noticed that the Rupert Murdoch, Times, Sun, News of the World, Empire made a big donation to the Republican Party as well. So there's
All of the big money is switching to the Republicans now before the November congressional
election. But back quickly to Max Kaiser and his Kaiser Report. He talks here also this week about the global hedge funds, who he says really are in control of the global financial system and the shadow banking system. So I'll ask you about that after we've heard from Max.
The currency movements are in the hands of the hedge funds, the global hedge funds, who are in the U.S. active in actually being the buyer of U.S. Treasury markets through the shadow banking system, as Gordon Brown, former Prime Minister of UK, used to call it the shadow banking system. So the hedge funds are determining the direction of currencies, which determines prices of stuff that people actually use. So until there's an effort to decapitalize these pernicious hedge funds whose interests are not aligned with any country at all, they're just purely self-interested parasites, until there's a move to decapitalize them, then this volatility will not cease.
Okay, Martin, what is the shadow banking system that Gordon Brown apparently has been talking about?
Well, it's not just Gordon Brown. I mean, what's happened is that the banking system used to be a regulated system. Effectively, retail banks used to just take people's deposits and lend money out to people to do things. But they've basically created a whole system of transactions and exchanges which is not regulated, which is carried out under the table. Nobody really knows how it works or who's involved or what the amounts of money involved are, but we do know that this black economy, if you like, of banking is far bigger than the official banking sector.
And is Max right about these hedge funds? Are they really that powerful?
They are. What we need to do, frankly, is we need to make most of the things that they trade in, like collateralized debt obligations and structured investment vehicles, illegal. It's quite simple. What you do is you just say, we're not going to enforce these contracts in law. So if you buy one of these things, you're absolutely right. You can't take people to court if they turn out to be rotten, and at that point people will stop using them. We should never have allowed this kind of speculative investment to take place in the first place. And the only way out of the crisis, frankly, is to cancel most of these debt obligations and start again, which means that some people will have to lose an awful lot of money. But that's the way of it, isn't it?
Okay, Farouk, mate, do you want to have the final word on this one?
It's very, very hard to make mistake. And you need to learn a lesson from the mistake. And although this mistake is very painful, but I'm sure and I think the politician and everyone will look at the how to tackle, to repeat this sort of mistake again. And I'm sure the especially the Labour government, they worked previously, and we are in a stage we work in to tighter the legislation, as you can say.
Okay, well, staying with the Labour Party, and it's Labour leadership time. The party faces a vital decision, doesn't it? Can I start off by asking you two, you're both Labour Party members, who you will be voting for in the Labour leadership elections? Farouk first.
Although I haven't mentioned it publicly who I will be voting, because every candidate is approaching their opinion, but I have my own views. I'm waiting on 9th of September, there would be a hustling in Bristol. So that would be an opportunity as a member for us to hear all five of them. And then probably I will finally make my mind.
Okay, and is there anyone you don't think you'll be voting for?
I won't be voting for one person, which she is a MP from London.
That's Diane Abbott. She's the only woman standing.
Yeah, I won't be voting for her.
Why is that?
Because of many reasons. One of the reasons is she sent her children to private school. And how can you send your child to private school and you fight for the public state school? To my mind, it's not really the right way to approach. And I won't vote for her.
Okay, so Martin, what about you? Who do you think you're going to vote for? You're not going to be. Don't tell me you're going to be waiting till 9th of September.
No. I mean, I certainly won't be voting for David Miliband, because he represents to me everything about the new Labour era which I wasn't happy about. This is a chance for us to change the direction.
But for example? Because the new Labour.
For example, the Iraq War. He voted for the Iraq War.
But surely Labour wouldn't have got into power unless it had been new Labour.
I was perfectly happy with the direction new Labour was taking at the beginning. But what eventually happened was two things. They stopped, for example, taking any notice of what was happening in the financial markets. They were culpable for allowing all of this stuff to happen, because they bought into the Thatcherite view that the market was infallible. That's not just nonsense, really. I mean, the crisis has just demonstrated why that's wrong. And I think we got ourselves into trouble, A, because we didn't really understand the nature of the financial markets, and we were too cowardly to tackle them. And secondly, of course, the big problem was all of this following along and behind George Bush, bombing, killing, and massacring. And that's these are serious. A lot of people switched from the Labour Party as a result of the Iraq War and in this city and voted for the Liberals. And that was a big mistake. I mean, I think many of them are probably regretting that now. But I mean, those are the two big things that went wrong under New Labour. And I'm afraid David Miliband is associated with both of those two big problems.
But Labour still haven't put their house in order. We're going over now to this sort of family fix-up politics between the Milibands that we've had in the States, for example.
Well, I mean, I think actually it's quite interesting, because Ed Miliband is a credible alternative to David. The others are not really, haven't really got the same oomph. And I suspect it's going to be a very close result, actually.
But don't you think Big Brother is going to have quite a lot of influence over Little Brother?
Well, I think obviously it's caused some problems between them. And their mother, in fact, is going to be voting for Diane Abbott. So that's how she's resolving her dilemma.
But I mean, a leadership election sort of degenerating into a kind of family squabble. This isn't real politics, is it? Farouk?
Well, what I'm thinking to make my decision is who would be the best person out of five to run this country? Because we have to think this Prime Minister is not only running this country, he has lots of influence overseas and abroad. So we have to take a really seriously consideration that who would be the right person to run the country, number one. Number two is who would be the right person when it goes to next to the other two leaders. You know, and to my mind, that's what I'm looking for, which candidate. I'm not too much care about the new Labour or old Labour. As far as I know, or I think, is the new Labour, or Tony Blair led the new Labour, has won 3-time election, so they have the argument as well. So we need to see who would be the best person for our party, for our country, and led to the next election.
But do you think that this, the democracy in the Labour Party is functioning properly when you've got two people in the same family have managed to get onto the ballot paper?
That is the proper democracy. That's why, you know, two brother both wants to be a party leader, and which really encouraging, you know, and we are lucky enough to have these two brothers in our party, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a pity we can't have their father, Ralph Miliband, who wrote a very good book, The State and in Capitalist Society, in the 1970s. He was an academic.
So you're saying they've come to power on the coattails of their father?
Well, their father would have regarded both of them as far too right wing, frankly. But you know, I think it's they are a very brainy family. That's got to be said. And I think either of them, I've been critical of David Miliband there, but I mean, he's a very high quality person. I just don't quite agree with his political views. Ed Miliband is a similarly high quality person, but I think he's a fresh face. He means he's not associated with the past, and for my money, I think he's got a lot to offer.
Right, let's go over to Wednesday's Evening Post, where we hear that the lights switch off has been stalled by City Council's bureaucracy. A campaigner against unnecessary traffic lights condemned Bristol City Council's decision not to go ahead with switch off of traffic lights despite a successful trial. Martin Cassini helped bring about the switch off of the heavily criticised lights at Portishead's cab stand, and is a staunch supporter of the Evening Post campaign to turn off pointless lights across Bristol. But he's accused the council of allowing bureaucracy to defeat progress. Farouk, what do you know about this issue, and are you in favour of switching off traffic lights just to see how the traffic flows? And apparently, in Portishead, it flows a lot better without them.
That's true, but there are always, I mean, you can say the council or anyone will do the right decision, but sometimes we make mistake. And we learn from our mistake. And the council introduced, I'm not defending council in this point, but the officers, they use their old judgment, I'm sure, and consultation and experience, and they decided to put the lights on. And I'm sure they are working on it. So, you know, it has been resolved previously, and it will be resolved, I'm sure.
Martin?
Well, obviously, it's a technical matter, isn't it? I mean, traffic lights are sometimes necessary, and maybe help the traffic flow better, and other times perhaps they're not.
Well, why can't we do what they do in Switzerland and places like that, where as soon as it comes out of a peak time, the traffic lights automatically switch over and they start blinking amber?
Well, what we really need is an integrated transport policy.
I mean,
and maybe free public transport, if we're really looking at what we really want.
Can you address that specific point, though? Because, I mean, technology and electronics has moved on a bit since the Ice Age, you know, and surely we can see when the times of day are when it's not peak traffic.
There's been very interesting experiments, I think, in Holland, where they've removed all traffic lights and other traffic control measures and have relied entirely upon people's good sense to move the traffic around. But of course, that is in a context where in Dutch cities you've got trams, you've got all sorts of infrastructure which allows people to move around the city without using cars. I mean, one of the problems in Bristol, as everybody knows, is the congestion. It's a huge problem because we've just got far too many cars on the road all the time. And ultimately, in the long run, we're going to have to move away from a very individualistic car-based society and economy if we want to have a better quality of life. We can't just keep piling cars onto the road, and cities like Bristol just can't stand the strain.
Well, Councillor Gary Hopkins, who's in charge of this area in the Cabinet, says we're looking at part-time lights. It depends on the location. If you're driving on a Sunday morning and traffic lights are on at a roundabout, there's clearly a good cause for asking why they are in operation. So, Farouk, why hasn't the Council actually got its finger out and done something about this?
Well, then again, I have to say that Gary, this is the Lib Dem administration, and we have to see what they come up. But if that was a Labour administration, we would take prompt action and resolve this issue. So I'm sure we have to wait and see what they come up with.
Okay, on to our next story. An MP is demanding a judicial inquiry into News of the World's phone hacking claims. The Labour MP Tom Watson has called for yesterday's Guardian, a full judicial inquiry into allegations of widespread illegal phone hacking at the News of the World. And the embarrassing thing is, the editor of the News of the World at the time all this was allegedly taking place was the UK Prime Minister's PR guru, Andy Coulson. London in Britain's government came under pressure yesterday, and this is MSNBC, amid allegations that a top prime ministerial aide was involved in illegally tapping cell phones of members of the royal family. In a previous job as editor at one of the country's leading tabloids, the Prime Minister David Cameron's media advisor, Andy Coulson, was claimed to have discussed with his staff about keeping tabs on the first in line to the throne, Prince Charles, and his sons, William and Harry. The New York Times reported that Coulson has always denied involvement or any knowledge of the phone tapping, insisted a rogue journalist was responsible. Martin, do you want to start on this one? Because this isn't entirely new. It's just this is the first time we've had MPs actually calling for judicial inquiries into what actually went on at the News of the World.
Well, Andy Coulson is if you like, David Cameron's Alistair Campbell. And one of the problems with being an Alistair Campbell figure like Coulson is you don't want to be the story. Your job is to spin the stories for the Prime Minister, and you don't want your name to be the main thing that people are talking about. So I think David Cameron, if this goes on and Coulson is basically found to have been involved in illegal phone tapping, I think Cameron will have to just jettison him.
The Murdoch's News Corp was actually awarded the biggest ever in journalism damages claim a couple of years ago whilst against Andy Coulson when he was at the News of the World. And this is simply for bullying. But anyway, Farouk, what are your thoughts about this? And do you think that Andy Coulson is being just literally sort of the press are just simply having a go at him for their own sake?
Well, I had this on the news this afternoon, actually, in my car, and I was quite shocked. It is a crime being committed, and I'm sure police has been investigating that. And if it's proofs, I think this is David Cameron and those people who are involved, they have to go. And it has to be a serious punishment, and police has to wider, you know, maybe them... which really, when I heard the news, it's really, I was thinking straight away, are we affected with those sort of hacking business? And I was thinking that as well.
Well, I know John Prescott said that he believed that his mobile phone had been hacked into by News of the World, even though he may be wrong. He was saying that anyway. Also, it's worth mentioning that Rupert Murdoch, the owner of the News of the World and many, many other media corporations, is at Sun Valley in Idaho this week. And he was actually interviewed by Fox News, one of his own network. And the first question they asked him was about this very subject.
The who's who of media, technology and the investment world all gathering right now, gathering at the 27th annual Allen & Company Conference in Sun Valley, Idaho. One of the biggest names there is News Corporation's Chairman and Chief Executive Officer, Rupert Murdoch, who joins us right now. Mr. Chairman, thanks very much for joining us. We appreciate it, sir.
Fine. Good afternoon.
The story that is really buzzing all around the country and certainly here in New York is that the News of the World, a News Corporation newspaper in Britain,
I'm not talking about that issue at all today. I'm sorry.
Okay. No worries, Mr. Chairman. That's fine with me.
I'm too far removed out of here.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
That's all right, sir.
So there was Rupert Murdoch refusing to answer any questions about that particular question. What are your thoughts, Martin, about this whole issue and how Murdoch's dealing with it?
Well, it just goes to show, doesn't it? He's involved in hacking into the royal family's telephones.
Allegedly,
perhaps. But when he's questioned about it, he doesn't want to comment.
But two journalists have already been actually jailed who were working under Andy Coulson at the time for this.
Yeah. So, in other words, that's no wonder he doesn't want to comment. I mean, basically, people like Mr. Murdoch have far too much power. Far too much. When the Labour government was in power, Lance Percival, who was a party advisor to the cabinet, he said,
"Is this the comedian?"
No. I think it was Lance Percival. I can't remember the name. I remember reading it that he was saying that there was always a 13th member of the cabinet, which was Rupert Murdoch. Now we've got a situation where one man is in a position to actually basically determine government policy, and no doubt he's got similar influence in the current cabinet. This is totally unacceptable. All of his newspapers and magazines and television stations all over the world all 100% supported the invasion of Iraq. He's got far too much power.
And after Rupert Murdoch refuses to answer the question, it's quite difficult to hear because the presenter is talking over him. But Murdoch also then seems to say, "Look, I'm too tired to move out of here." So he's almost like he's threatening to sort of walk out of the interview unless the interviewer passes on to something else. Anyway, Farouk, what's your thought about this sort of pact that the politicians have with these powerful media people like Murdoch? Because, I mean, really, New Labour really had an alliance with Rupert Murdoch to get in the first place.
That's true. And I agree with Martin. Rupert Murdoch has too much power and too much money. And it's all about money, unfortunately. And that's why the big politician and big parties has a close link with wealthy people and people like Rupert Murdoch. And I think the it's a really fragile the situation is the journalist who was interviewing. I think he was employed by Rupert Murdoch. That's why you can see Sir, and Sir is not giving the answer, and there is no further question to the Sir. Those Sir business got to be dealt with. And
there was a great TV drama series, I don't know if either you remember it, in the 80s, Max Headroom. And he was quite often finding stories to do with the big Network 23 that he worked for, and in which case they would switch off his signal, you know. Anyway, let's move on to another story now. And the CIA apparently is paying the officials around Mohammad Karzai, the Prime Minister of Afghanistan, secret payments to multiple members of President Mohammad Karzai's administration, in part to maintain sources of information in a government in which the Afghan leader is often seen as having a limited grasp of developments, according to former US officials. So, Martin, do you want to start on this one? The CIA actually bankrolling the government in Afghanistan. This is pretty shocking.
It's hardly surprising, isn't it?
Well, no,
government, and they pay for, the puppet masters pay the puppets, don't they? I mean, that's pretty normal. Why is anybody surprised by this?
Well, because I would have imagined that the Afghan administration themselves are paying these people, not the Central Intelligence Agency.
Well, more to the point, of course, Wali Karzai, Karzai's brother, has been named by the DEA as the main drug dealer in Afghanistan, and he is also on the CIA's payroll. And we've covered this in previous weeks, the CIA's involvement in the hard drugs trade over many decades. Don't forget, Khalid Karzai wasn't elected. There was a fraudulent election in Afghanistan, far more fraudulent than anything we saw in Iran. So this is a puppet regime kept in power by foreign forces, and if the foreign forces left, the regime would fall because they don't actually have any popular support. And that's what we're fighting for, to keep them in power, just as we fought to keep the South Vietnamese generals in power for a decade in the 1970s.
I wouldn't be surprised because of the corruption, because I know corruption is everywhere in Afghanistan. And I wouldn't be surprised to CIA involvement as well, because if you look back the history of Taliban when Russian was there, who trained, who financed the Taliban is CIA and is America. Now the CIA and America turning the other way around with the Taliban. I wouldn't be surprised, and it is another politics, isn't it? Because they need to see my people or their people are there, basically. And the whole subject is basically very chaotic, the Afghanistan subject. And it won't be, the peace will not happen until And unless the corruption is not there and bringing everyone, every groups, every individual on the tables to discussion, otherwise I don't think we can see any peace.
Well, former CIA officer Michael Schur told Germany, would agree with you, he told Germany's Der Spiegel magazine this week in reference to Afghanistan's dodgy president Hamid Karzai, probably the only incorrupt people in Afghanistan are the Taliban. If you want no corruption, give the government back to the Taliban. That was in Ephraim Hardcastle's diary in the Daily Mail on the 1st of September. Is he just taking the mickey there, Martin? Is there, you know, is that sensible?
Well, I mean, what's happened when David Miliband was foreign secretary, he was floating the idea of discussions with the Taliban. Because ultimately, I mean, you have to bring all political forces into a political solution. And if they've got support on the ground, then you've got to deal with them. But of course, the Taliban at the moment, and they're not actually a united movement. There's lots and lots of different factions within. I mean, basically, it's very localized, the resistance in Afghanistan, as far as I can see. Each valley's got its own structure, as it were. So we use the word Taliban to cover what is basically a wide resistance movement with lots of different features. But basically, they're not interested in talking to the Western powers at the moment because they're winning the war. That's what the Taliban spokespeople in Pakistan are saying. We're not interested in talking to you. We're winning.
No one's winning the war. It's just who is suffering is citizen and civilians, you know, the loss of people getting killed, thousands of people getting killed.
So what should British policy be out there then?
I think the British policy should be, we need to, anywhere, any peace process, my opinion would be, you need to bring each and every individual and groups, because they are part of the country or part of the nation or part of the area. If there is a five people there and talking to three people, it won't be resolved. The other two people will always be against with anything because you left them out. So Taliban, I don't know, that's what they say, terrorist and, you know, all sorts of blame or we hear, but I think we need to bring, and British involvement should be bringing everyone together if we want to see a peaceful Afghanistan.
And how long do you think we should keep the troops over there?
I think we should not keep the troops up there at all. That's my opinion, because Taliban is, yes, they are organized, but they are not well equipped to attack us or any other country. I do not think we can safeguard our countries, but leave their country alone. That's my personal opinion.
Okay, next story. A family have won an 18-year fight over the measles, mumps and rubella damage to their son. £90,000 payout was the first since concerns over the vaccine surfaced. And the BBC relegated this to a local story up in Merseyside where this family's from, but a mother whose son suffered severe brain damage after he was given the controversial MMR vaccine as a baby has been awarded £90,000 in compensation. This is from the Mail on Sunday. The judgment is the first of its kind to be revealed since concerns were raised about the safety of the triple jab. Robert Fletcher, 18, is unable to talk, stand, unaided or feed himself. He endures frequent epileptic fits and requires round-the-clock care from his parents, Jackie and John, though he is not autistic. Martin, this is a little bit worrying. What do you think about the safety of the MMR jab? Because we're being told constantly it's perfectly safe, there's no evidence, and then we've got a £90,000 payout.
I'm a political pundit, not a doctor. And I don't really feel competent to say one way or another whether the MMR jab is viable or not. I mean, we very much depend in our modern society on people who are experts to tell us whether things are safe or not. And of course, there has to be checks and balances. And sometimes, as we know, whether it's traffic lights or injections, people get things wrong.
But this is bizarre, isn't it? Because the guy, the doctor that recommended this or was suggesting that MMR was dangerous has been kicked out of the profession by the council. So what are people supposed to believe?
Well, one of the problems with vaccination as a whole is that you may find it, let's just have a hypothetical case where you're vaccinating against a very serious illness which can be epidemic, you know, something like smallpox or whatever, but say 1% of the people you vaccinate get complications. Now, what you've got there is a trade-off between that 1% of people who have complications and the 99% of people who are protected from the potential epidemic disease. And these kind of choices are what we have medical ethics councils and so on for, because it's always quite tricky, because you're trading off one person's health against somebody else's health. This is why vaccine, you know, if people are not taking out vaccines against measles now, and that could lead to epidemics of measles, couldn't it?
Yeah, I'm not a doctor or expert of this issue, but again, it can, the doctor sometime make mistake, but we need to see, was it being done deliberately?
But you see, this is less, I think, to do with individual doctors and much more to do with the pharmaceutical industry and their relationship with the government medical advisors.
Well, that's another issue. I mean, the pharmaceutical industry has a profit motive, and often they are pushing certain kinds of drugs and I mean, remember all the fuss about swine flu a couple of years ago, or a year ago now. I mean, a lot of money was made by the pharmaceutical industry selling the antidote to swine flu, and you know that this is not just independent impartial advice that they're giving. They're a profit oriented. I mean, I think that's a classic case of something that should be put in the public hands. I mean, in Bangladesh some years ago, the government tried to bring in their own production of drugs, didn't they, to get away from the pharmaceutical companies.
But look, the bottom line is, both of you, Martin, you first, then you, Farouk, would you allow your children to have the MMR jab?
I think I probably would.
I probably would, yes. Although I have to ask my wife.
Okay. All right, well, thanks very much for joining us, Farouk. I know you've got to dash off to an important meeting now, but thanks very much for joining us. That's Farouk Chowdhury, who's Labour City Councillor for Easton. Now, anthrax is potentially the world's most deadly bioweapon. We've all heard of the plague and other pestilences of years gone by, and today we like to think that would never happen again. But rumours have surfaced again in the press this week that the government scientist who exposed Alistair Campbell, Tony Blair and MI6's dodgy dossier in the build-up to the illegal invasion of Iraq, that's Dr. David Kelly, may have upset people with a book he was preparing to publish about anthrax when he died. Kelly was found dead in the woods, as he himself eerily predicted, and many people now believe his death was not suicide. Liberal Democrat MP for Lewis in Sussex, Norman Baker, has written a book all about Kelly's death, The Strange Death of David Kelly. But, as you're about to hear, a criminal investigation into alleged misuse of anthrax at the UK's Biological Weapons Research Centre, Porton Down in Wiltshire, codenamed Operation Adler, was halted by the Crown Prosecution Service just 2 days before David Kelly died. Anyway, two US investigative journalists, Bob Cohen and Eric Nadler, have produced a documentary on the subject entitled Anthrax Wars, and here's an extract.
Porton Down, the UK's secret biological and chemical weapons complex. Porton Down had received the AIM strain from Fort Detrick in the 80s.
Look at this. Prohibited. Now Porton Down.
David Kelly had been head of microbiology at Porton Down. At the time of his death, Porton Down was the target of a major police investigation. Codenamed Operation Antler, it looked into deaths and injuries to British soldiers caused by secret experiments conducted between 1939 and 1989. Attorney Alan Kerr represented some of the victims.
There were experiments, for example, putting men in gas chambers and subjecting them to sarin nerve gas, a chemical warfare weapon, to mustard gas, to Lewisite, to CS gas, which is used for riot control, and also including other substances, for example, the biological agent Pyrexial.
After a 3-year investigation, the police had enough evidence to recommend the prosecution of 8 cases against Porton Down scientists. But just days before Kelly's death in July 2003, the Crown Prosecutor dropped the case.
The Operation Antler investigation wasn't referred to in the Hutton report. And yet, so you basically have 30 detectives who are investigating the goings-on at Porton Down in terms of criminal behaviour. You have Kelly's death, and the two are never put together. It seems very odd. It seems like something dropping behind the filing cabinet, but...
Human experiments at Porton Down are part of the untold story of the international effort to add biological weapons to the arsenal of war.
Well, you had a collaboration which started off between Britain and Canada in 1940. That expanded, gradually bringing the Americans in. And that then became a division of labor. Research work, for instance, tended to happen in Britain. The idea that production would happen in the United States, field testing, munitions would happen in Canada.
This collaboration required America's military lab, Fort Detrick, to work closely with Porton Down. Fort Detrick scientist Frank Olson was a liaison between the two facilities. On November 28, 1953, Olson fell 13 stories from a New York City hotel room. Was his death part of the pattern of mysterious deaths of bioweapon scientists, including that of anthrax letter suspect Bruce Ivins, also of Fort Detrick? Did all three scientists know too much? If there is a common thread that ties together a series of untimely deaths of military microbiologists, it may begin with Fort Detrick scientist Frank Olson. His son Eric is convinced his father's plunge from a hotel window was neither accident nor suicide.
He had knowledge about experiments on human subjects. He had knowledge about, you know, extreme interrogation methods leading to death of the subjects. If there was a scary point during the Cold War, that was it.
Frank Olson was an anthrax delivery systems expert, working for the CIA's Special Operations, a covert division at Fort Detrick. His son says Frank Olson wanted out.
What's striking to me is you were bound to get situations during the Cold War where certain scientists, certain policymakers, certain administrators, certain military people knew what was going on and said, you know, we're not doing this. This is not what the United States should be doing. And the question is, what were you going to do with such people? You couldn't put them on trial. You couldn't even put them on military trial. Because in many cases, the stuff they were doing, it had such a level of secrecy attached to it that you couldn't even deny it. So when a guy like that says he's had enough and he's quitting...
It was not until 1975, 22 years after Olson's death, that the government said he had been given LSD and then jumped out of the window. His son never believed it. In 1994, Eric Olson had his father's body exhumed. One of America's leading forensic pathologists studied the x-rays and determined Frank Olson had suffered a blow to the forehead before falling to his death.
But you really have to start by seeing the not what went on in that little bloody hotel room, but the broader historical picture.
Frank Olson and Bruce Ivins, both Fort Detrick scientists, both dead in controversial circumstances, 50 years apart. David Kelly at Porton Down, another questionable death. All three scientists working with anthrax in state biological research programs. Programs justified in large part by the fact the Russians had been weaponizing deadly germs. Fear of a nightmare scenario in which smaller nations might also develop bioweapons had led the U.S. to initiate the treaty outlawing offensive programs.
The 1972 Biological Weapons Convention, probably the strongest disarmament treaty in human history, right? Because it outlawed not only the use of the weapons, it outlawed the stockpiling of it, it outlawed the development of them. And it was really an excellent treaty. And I know most of us thought, whew, thank goodness, there is one threat to human health and welfare that's been put back into the box.
In fact, the Soviet program was never put back into the box. Ken Alabek oversaw a vast secret bioweapons program.
I got an order from the Soviet government to develop an industrial process for anthrax industrial manufacturing and a new type biological weapon.
In 1989, as the Cold War was ending, a top Soviet bioweapons scientist who worked with Alabek defected to the West. Vladimir Pasechnik was debriefed by David Kelly on behalf of British intelligence.
That debriefing is extremely interesting because for the very first time, Britain and America became aware of what the Soviet Union had been doing about biological warfare.
Deep in inside Russia, bordering Siberia, Yekaterinburg was once a key center of the Soviet Union's bioweapons program. The legacy of this illicit program hangs over the city today. In 1979, one single gram of anthrax escaped Compound 19, a secret army germ warfare lab. The spores carried over the sleeping city by the wind infected thousands and killed at least 66 people. Dr. Lev Grinberg was a state pathologist at the time of the accident.
At first, we thought that it was the plague and not anthrax, because anthrax and the plague are very similar.
The majority of the people in this building died. All of us that worked in the factory, each day we expected to hear that someone else had died. Many died. How can I remember them now?
In the local cemetery, Cohn searched for the unmarked section where the victims of the anthrax outbreak were buried in specially made lead-lined coffins. The Soviets never admitted that the anthrax came from a military lab. However, Dr. Grinberg and his colleagues were able to determine the victims had been killed by pulmonary anthrax. The spores had been weaponized, so they were tiny enough to be inhaled, just like the anthrax spores in the U.S. attacks.
Well, that was Anthrax Wars documentary, and an extract from it by U.S. investigative journalists Bob Cohen and Eric Nadler, looking at links between Operation Adler, which is a criminal investigation which was going on into alleged misuse of the bioweapon anthrax at the British government's Bioweapons Research Centre in Wiltshire. That's Porton Down. Well, we're coming up to the Sky News at 6 in a minute. Thanks to this week's guest, you just heard depart there urgently for a meeting at 10 to 6, Labour Councillor for Eastern Farouk Chowdhury. After the news, Bristol City Council's parks sell-off bombshell. Back in June, it was announced in the Bristol Evening Post that the council's planning to sell off 62 parks, bits of parks and other green spaces around the city for housing. I went along to a council consultation at Arnos Vale Hotel yesterday to find out what you think of the plan. And I'm joined in the studio by some of the campaigners. So join us after the news.
On BCFM 93.2 FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.